And welcome back to Coast. Professor Ron Mallett is a professor of theoretical physics at the University of Connecticut. Professor Mallett's breakthrough research on time travel has been featured all over the world. And he recently published his memoir, Time Traveler, a compelling and human story of a man whose deep childhood trauma drove him on a quest to build a time machine. And we're going to talk about that. He's back on Coast to Coast. Ron, how are you?
Fine, George. How are you?
Good. Good to have you back with us.
Thank you.
Have we gotten time travel down to a science yet?
Well, it's always been a science. We're still working on trying to get to the past. We've been to the future. Not with my work, but that actually has happened with other work. In fact, you used an example of it just when you introduced the show. That was a good example.
About the old train speeding ahead.
Matter of fact, we've done that, but using now jets. I mean, and what the public doesn't realize is that's an experiment that has been done, it's been repeated, and it has allowed us to go to actually show that it's possible to go into the future. And it was an experiment that was done in 1971 at the Naval Observatory, in which they took two clocks. They kept one stationary at the Naval Observatory, and they put another on a passenger jet. This experiment's actually called the Hafele-Keating experiment, and they flew the plane around the world close to the speed of sound, and when they brought it back, they found that the clock on board the plane had indeed slowed down compared to the clock that had been stationary at the Naval Observatory, just in exactly the way that Einstein had predicted. And, of course, what that means is that, and when we're talking about a clock, that means any timekeeping mechanism, including the human heart.
That
the scientists on board, their clock, their heart rate had slowed down. It was by fractions of a second, but this meant that, in a sense, they were younger than their colleagues that had been stationary, and so that meant that they had actually traveled fractions of a second into the future.
If I'm in the Midwest doing shows out of St. Louis, Ron, I'm 2 hours ahead of California time.
Right.
Theoretically, am I time traveling into the future when you're 2 hours ahead of a different time zone?
No. Time zones are just, that is sort of an arbitrary designation. That's not really time travel at all. That's just simply a way in which we have of separating time intervals. When I talk about time travel, or when these scientists are talking about time travel, they're talking about time that is independent of how you arbitrarily slice it up into time zones. So this would be an effect that is totally independent. So when you go from one time zone to another, you're not really time traveling. You're just resetting your clock in an arbitrary way, and that's not the same thing. If someone was time traveling, in a sense, it wouldn't matter what zone they were in. The speed that they were traveling is the thing that would determine whether or not their clock slowed down, and that's an effect that's independent of the time zone that you're in.
How far back, Ron, did the discussion of time travel begin? I mean, did it go way beyond Einstein, maybe back into the 1500s, 1600s?
Well, actually, and this is something that I think is really intriguing, is the real, in a sense, scientific discussion of it, or you might say based on a mechanism, actually started back in 1895 with H.G. Wells. With his book, The Time Machine. Now, the discussion of time travel went even earlier than H.G. Wells, I should mention. In fact, I'm here in Connecticut, and one of the most famous stories is the Connecticut Yankee King Arthur's Court, which was done by Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm.
But that story required something like, you know, bump on the head. You know, I mean, up until H.G. Wells, lightning had to strike, some supernatural.
Some quirk had to happen, yeah.
Right. But H.G. Wells was the first to actually introduce the notion of a mechanism. The other thing is that H.G. Wells is the first to actually explicitly state in his story that time is the fourth dimension. Now, this is actually 10 years before Einstein, in a scientific way, introduced it, but as a fictional concept. And so this notion of actually traveling through time by utilizing a scientific mechanism, that was introduced in 1895, and the notion of fourth dimension. It wasn't until Einstein's work And I think it's important sometimes to realize, because when people say, well, you know, why should time slow down the faster you move? I mean, you know, that's a statement that's made. But it really has to do with Einstein's understanding in 1905 of the fact that this is all rooted in the fact that the speed of light is something that doesn't change. And even that notion, I mean, how did that come about? I mean, that's something that I think, you know, one should go back and look at the roots of these things in the science to see why it comes about, because sometimes the statements sound like they're just arbitrary, you know. And when I talk about the speed of light, for example, if let me just use a very, very simple example.
Sure.
Suppose that I'm pitching a baseball at you, okay?
All right.
And I'm just standing still and throwing the ball at you at a certain speed, okay? Let's say, you know, 10 miles an hour, which a good pitcher can do.
And at that rate, I could probably hit it.
Right. Now, the thing is that suppose that I am running towards you and throw the ball, okay? If I'm running towards you and throwing the ball, then depending on how fast I'm coming towards you, the ball isn't just going to be coming at you at 10 miles an hour. It's going to be coming at you plus the speed that I'm running.
That's right. That's right.
Okay? And in fact, you know, when you watch a pitcher on the mound, you know, they get that motion forward, but they're not just simply tossing it, you know, at a stationary speed. So the thing is that, so that's common sense. Now, when you think about light, let's suppose that I have a flashlight and I shine the light at you. Now, when a light beam is coming towards you, you have to remember that another one of Einstein's major breakthroughs was to realize that that beam of light, even though it looks like a continuous beam, it's actually made up of particles of light. These particles of light, which you could actually think of as balls of light.
One after another?
That's right. That's right. They're a stream, okay, coming at you, a stream of balls of light that are coming at you, and they're called photons. And these are coming at you at 186,000 miles per second, okay? Now, if I'm just standing there and shining the flashlight at you, these stream of these balls of light are coming at you at 186,000 miles per second. Now, if I'm running towards you with the flashlight, then just like, you know, running towards you and throwing the ball, then you would expect these balls of light to be coming at you faster.
You would think so, yeah.
That's right. You'd be wrong. And in fact, an experiment that was done was called the Michelson-Morley experiment that was done in 1887. That experiment was actually to test that, and they fully expected that to happen. Now, in their case, the runner was the Earth. What they did was the Earth travels in its orbit about 18 miles per second, and they were expecting that whenever you shine light on the moving Earth, that the motion of the Earth is going to affect the speed of light. And what they found was it didn't affect it at all. You have to realize how weird that is. That would be the same as my saying that this ball I'm tossing at you is going to be coming at you at the same speed, regardless of whether I'm standing still or running towards you. That doesn't make sense. And in fact, it didn't make sense until Einstein came along. Einstein said that light is very, very special. Light is the only thing that doesn't change with the speed of its source. And people say, why is that so? What Einstein showed was that the only way that that can happen, the only way that the speed of light can stay the same, no matter how fast the source of light is moving, is something else has to change. And that something is time. In other words, the reason why the speed of light doesn't change is that time changes. So that's the basis of it. You see, that's the root. And the thing is that what he showed was that the faster the source moves, the more time has to slow down in order for the speed of light to stay the same. So that's the root. And as I said, sometimes that's not stated clearly why that, you know, was so. Now, it wasn't until many years later that we actually found that this was the case, that in fact time did slow down for a moving clock. And the faster the clock moves, the more time slows down. And as I said, one of the most recent experiments, and this is another hallmark of science, because people talk about different types of experiments. the hallmark of science is repeatability. That is to say that this experiment, the Hassel-Keating experiment with the atomic clocks on board the passenger jet, that was repeated again at the University of Maryland in 1976. It's been repeated again in 1990. I mean, it's been done again and again and again at higher and higher speeds, and we know that it's so, and that we actually see this effect in satellites. When satellites are moving rapidly through space, their clocks actually are slowing down compared to the clocks here on the surface of the Earth. So this means that, once again, the effect depends on how fast you're going. So if you go, even if you're traveling, you know, close to the speed of sound, or if you're traveling, you know, many times that, that still is just slow compared to the speed of light. So this, it only affects the clock by fractions of a second. But when you're talking about getting close to the speed of light itself, then it's going to be happening in terms of, as you had mentioned, in terms of hours and years. That is to say that a rocket that's going close to the speed of light, you can't get to the speed of light, and there's a reason for that. It's actually a law of nature. But you, if you get close enough to the speed of light, then the clock will slow down to such a point that if you were an astronaut going close to the speed of light, you might be out in space for just a few years, but when you came back to Earth, 100 years could pass. So you actually could travel into the future. And as I said, we've seen the baby steps in that. That's the important thing. We have already seen the baby steps of trying to, of time travel into the future with these experiments using ordinary passenger jets.
Do you think, Professor, that the consensus of science believes that one day, I don't know when, but one day we may truly be able to travel in time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I said, we've done it already. It's just that if we have rockets that can go fast enough, and I should mention that NASA was developing, and I hope that they still continue to get their funding to do that, advanced propulsion systems. Some of these have exotic names like ion engines and mm-hmm. so on. But these will eventually be able to go close to the speed of light, and when that happens, we will be traveling into the distant future, and we will have a chance it'll be almost like a common thing. Eventually, it's going to be very weird for astronauts if they happen to have families.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to have to commit themselves
to the fact that they
could travel into space and come back finding out that their families have grown up and that they are now the age of or younger than their grandchildren.
Or passed on.
But that will actually be something that's happening. As I said, we've already seen the baby steps towards that.
What if, Ron, something happened to the planet during one of these time travel escapades, and as these astronauts try to come back, there's nothing to come back to?
That could happen. You know, it's interesting. Sometimes in the science fiction movies, they get it right. And one of my favorites, I haven't seen the latest Planet of the Apes movie, but the original one with Charlton Heston.
Classic.
That, in fact, they did get it right. What happened was that their rocket had actually gone so fast, close to the speed of light, that it had come back in the distant future of the Earth, although those astronauts didn't realize it. They had landed on the planet. They thought they were on another planet.
That's right.
You know, but until the end. Right, until the end, until the shocking end.
Yeah.
That they finally realized that they were on the Earth in the distant future. But that is something that could happen.
How did Einstein do this? Create this knowledge simply with mathematics? The guy had never had a computer.
No, that's right, exactly. It's with mathematics and with imagination. You know, one of my favorite quotes of Einstein, and I mentioned it in my book, Time Traveler, and it is one of my favorite quotes, is that imagination is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited, but imagination encircles the world. And it was that. In other words, people have asked him how come he, you know, was able to see more than sometimes his colleagues. And it was not just simply knowledge, but it was his imagination. He imagined what it was like to try to ride along with a light beam. And it was this imagination of his. And then using the tools of mathematics that he was able to make this breakthrough.
How dramatic this will be when one day we're able to do this. And will it be, Ron, a machine that allows us to do it?
Well, yes. I mean, in a sense, a rocket is a machine, but there is another way. We've talked about speed, and we've talked about, and that is connected with the special theory of relativity. In other words, what we've been discussing is Einstein's first theory, which was developed in 1905, and it's called his special theory of relativity, which has to do with speeds relative to the speed of light. He developed another theory, which was in 1915, 10 years afterwards, and this has to do with gravity. And it turns out that not only does speed affect time, but it turns out that gravity can affect time too. And this is Einstein's general theory of relativity. And that theory, if we can control gravity with a device, then we can actually control time as well. And that could lead to a machine in the sense that we think of it sometimes in terms of a time machine in that sense. But as I said, a rapid rocket would be a time machine, but a stationary device might be created by if we could control gravity. And in fact, that's where my work comes in, and that's what my work is based on. But once again, I think it's important to realize that Einstein just didn't say that gravity can affect time just like that. I mean, there was actually a reason for that. There was a basis for that statement, and that had to do with a problem that occurred with when he tried to apply his theory, his special theory of relativity, to gravity. And it's actually something that it's a puzzle that he had to resolve, and it's a simple puzzle to state. As an example, let's suppose that if we think about the Earth in its orbit around the sun, mm-hmm. you know that the Earth is 93 million miles away from the sun, and it takes about 8 minutes for light to go from the sun to the Earth.
That's right.
Okay, now, let's suppose there was a cosmic catastrophe that somehow destroyed the sun. What would we see? Now, that's a very important statement, the way I said it. What would we see? Well, if the sun was destroyed, it would take almost a full 8 minutes before we would see the sun go out.
And even know about it.
Long, you know, for the light to get from the sun to the Earth. So even though the sun is no longer there, since it takes 8 minutes, we would still see the sun in the sky. I always tell people it's kind of weird when you think about it. Our entire life, when you look out in the sun, you are not seeing the way the sun is now. You are always only seeing the sun the way it was 8 minutes ago.
Well, and you could be looking at a star, Ronald, as you know, that burned out millions of years ago.
That's right, exactly. When we look out at the night sky, in a sense, all those stars that are out there, those stars that are there, may not even be there anymore. And depending on how far away they are from us, if they're 10,000 light years away from us, then that star may have perished 10,000 years ago. And for us, even though we're still seeing it in the sky, it could be long gone.
Ronald, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back with Professor Ronald Mallett, author of Time Traveler. We're going to get into his work as well. It's an incredible story. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Professor Ron Mallett. His latest work, Time Traveler, a scientist's personal mission to make time travel a reality. Ronald, let's get into this. Tell me about this quest, this thing that has been pushing you all these years to time travel.
Well, the quest started for me many, many decades ago when I was only 10 years old. And it started with a major tragedy in my life. My father was the center of my world. He was just someone who, for me, the day began and the day ended with him. I mean, and I was the oldest of four children in the family, and he was an extraordinary individual. He had served in the Second World War. He was actually a battlefield medic in the European theater, and he used the GI Bill after he got out to go to the RCA Technical Institute, 2-year Technical Institute, become an electronic technician, and he specialized in fixing televisions. And he was someone who worked very, very hard. I mean, he was a very good at his job. I just mentioned that he was so good that he even fixed the television sets of people like Walter Matthau and Jackie Cooper. But sometimes, you know, what I love is the fact that I still have the pictures of that they were signed by Walter Matthau and Jackie Cooper, you know, telling him he was a great electronics man and thanking him for fixing the television set.
Cool.
But even though he worked hard, he loved his family. I mean, he loved having this large family. And the thing is that I thought that he was indestructible. He looked like he was extremely robust. And what none of us realized was that he had a weak heart. And he died suddenly of a massive heart attack.
Oh. Did he even know that?
No. Oh, well, he did.
He
but
did.
I think he kept it. You know, from, I mean, we didn't realize it at all. My mother must have known, and I'm sure he must have been taking some medication.
Yeah.
But, you know, in that time, I should mention that, you know, this was back in the 50s, and he was a heavy smoker, two-pack a day.
And we didn't have bypass. We didn't have stents then.
That's right. We didn't have any of the things that we have now, and we take for granted now. And that was one of the things that led to his death. So and that was like, for me, it was like the death of Superman, I should say. I mean, it was like, I couldn't believe it. It completely devastated my world. And I went from being a rather happy kid to a very depressed kid. But he gave me many gifts, not only scientific toys, but a thirst for reading. And about a year after he died, I came across, this was actually at that, initially, this was a comic version, was called the Classics Illustrated, a version of H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine. And it led me to read the original. And what that turned everything around for me. This was when I was 11, a year after he died. I thought, if I could build a time machine, then I could see him again. And in fact, the initial statement in the comic version was that scientific people know very well that time is a kind of space, that we can move forward and backward in time just as we can move forward and backward in space. And I thought, this is the answer. But I kept it a secret because even at the age of 11, I knew people were already worried about me. And if I told them that I wanted to build a time machine to see my father again, I'm not sure that I, you know, what the reaction would be. So I kept it as a secret project. But that was the beginning. And about a year after that, when I was 12, I came across a paperback in the Salvation Army. I started doing my book hunting there because that's all I could afford to do. It was it showed on the cover of it, showed Einstein next to a large-size hourglass. So I knew, and I had heard about this Einstein. I knew he was a genius. Matter of fact, coincidentally, he died. Just within a month of my father, he died the same year my father died, in 1955.
Huh.
And so when I saw this, it said to me, Einstein must have something to do with time just from the cover. And when I made my way through the book, it was a popular version, but I couldn't understand everything in it, but I could glean. It actually talked about this Michelson-Morley experiment. It talked about Einstein saying that time slowed down for a moving clock. So I knew that Einstein was going to be the answer somehow, that if I could understand Einstein, then what H.G. Wells was saying about time travel might be a possibility. So that became my second passion, was to try to understand Einstein. And eventually, that led to my going into physics. Now, I'm skipping through a lot, because it was after my father died, we went from the middle class to poverty. And it was not easy going.
Oh, your whole life was topsy-turvy, Ron.
It was topsy-turvy. I go into that much more detail in my book, Time Traveler. But in any case, ultimately, I went into the service, just like my father, because I couldn't afford to go directly to college. And in my case, it was the Air Force during the Vietnam War. But eventually, I used the GI Bill to go to Penn State, and I became a physicist. Once again, I kept it as a secret from people what my ultimate goal was, but I realized that by going into physics, this would be the key to finding out how to build a time machine. And eventually I found out that about Einstein's theories and about his special theory of relativity, about time being affected by motion, by speed, and also his general theory of relativity, which talks about gravity affecting it. And to lead into my breakthrough and how we have to back up a little bit to say how gravity affects time, because that's the core of my work and part of Einstein's. And I was mentioning earlier, you know, this problem that faced Einstein after he had developed his special theory of relativity, in which he was trying to understand gravity. And I mentioned this example of thinking about the Earth in orbit about the sun,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that if you destroyed the sun, because it's 93 million miles away from us, it would take 8 minutes for the light to get to us before we would see the sun go out. Here's the clincher. The thing is that according to Newton, gravity shuts down immediately. So you would have this very weird effect that we could actually see the sun out in the sky, but the Earth would be hurtling off into space. In other words, we wouldn't see the reason why all of a sudden there's nothing holding us in orbit around the sun, because gravity would shut down instantly. What that implies is that gravity could travel faster than the speed of light from the sun. And Einstein said that can't be, because light's the limiting speed. That's it. So what he had to do was to develop a whole new theory of gravity in which he would actually make gravity travel no faster than the speed of light. And that was called his general theory of relativity. And that was actually the core of his theory. And what he did was to actually, in a sense, he got rid of gravity as a force. And that's important to understand, because that's actually, as I said, part of the basis of my work. What he said was that what we call the force of gravity really is an illusion. And once again, there's a simple example and a simple way of seeing that that I like to think about. And that is to say that let's suppose that, imagine that right there you have in front of you sort of a small trampoline, let's say a stretched rubber sheet, okay, like a small trampoline.
Okay.
And think of that rubber sheet as being like empty space. And suppose that what you do is you take a bowling ball and you put it on that rubber sheet. What's going to happen? It's going to cause that rubber sheet to curve.
Curve, and probably into the middle, right?
Right, in the middle, right. So wherever you place the bowling ball, if you put the bowling ball in the middle of the rubber sheet, it's going to bend the rubber sheet there. Now suppose that you take a little marble and you put it on the rubber sheet. What's it going to do? The rubber, if you put a marble on the edge, it's going to roll down the rubber sheet to get to the bowling ball.
That's right, right down the curve.
Right. Now, imagine that the rubber sheet is there, but it's transparent. So we can't see the rubber sheet anymore. It's still there, but it's transparent. Now, when I put the marble on, the marble's going to roll down towards the bowling ball. But since you can't see the rubber sheet, you'll say, aha, what's happening is the bowling ball is creating a force on the marble, and it's pulling the marble towards the bowling ball, okay? But that's not what's really happening. You know that's what's really happening is that the bowling ball is curving the rubber sheet, and the marble is just moving along that curve. Well, that's what Einstein said is actually happening in empty space. The sun is actually curving the empty space around it, just like the bowling ball is curving the rubber sheet around it. And the Earth is just moving along that curve. In fact, if the Earth didn't have its little sideways motion, it keeps it in orbit, the Earth would actually roll towards the sun, just like the marble rolls towards the bowling ball. So what Einstein said, in fact, if we go back to the rubber sheet, in fact, if you take a marble and you do this, and you actually take the marble and you sort of throw it sideways, it'll actually make an orbit around the bowling ball like a skater on a roller derby ring. And so it will look like it's making an orbit around the bowling ball. And that's what happens when the solar system was created. The Earth, fortunately for us, was created with this little sideways motion. And that's why we stay in orbit.
We had a lot of things happen to make this work, didn't we?
Yeah, to make us be where we are, exactly. Now, the thing is that so what Einstein said is that it turns out that force of gravity is just this bending of empty space. That's what people, when scientists are referring to the warping of space, that's what they're referring, is that an object like the sun is actually bending or warping space around it, and objects like the Earth are just moving in that warp space. So Einstein essentially showed that what we call the force of gravity is actually this bending of empty space. And that's happening for any gravitating body. That is to say, the Earth itself is actually curving the space around it. And when we jump up off the ground, we, even though we can't see it, what's happening is that we are actually falling in that curved space created by the Earth, and it pulls us back to the Earth, back to the surface of the Earth.
Now, how does gravity equate then into your time travel theory?
Well, what Einstein, in fact, the thing that's really unique about Einstein's theory, besides this warping of space, is the fact that in Newton's theory, the only thing that can create the gravitational force is matter. Like, you know, the Earth creates gravity, which pulls us to it, and the Sun creates gravity, which keeps the Earth in orbit around it. It turns out that in Einstein's theory, not only can matter create gravity, but light, even though light is not matter, light can create gravity. And that's important. And it turns out that it's, even though light doesn't have matter, light has energy. And that energy of light is what can actually create gravity. In other words, that can actually bend space around it. My work is based on it. In fact, I can lead you very easily through my breakthrough.
Okay.
What Einstein realized was that this bending of space actually leads to a bending of time. And that is what I mean when I say that gravity can affect time. What Einstein realized was that a clock will actually slow down the stronger gravity is. That is to say that gravity here at the surface of the Earth is actually stronger than gravity at higher altitudes. According to Einstein, what he realized from his calculations was that this meant that a clock here at the surface of the Earth is actually going to be running slower than a clock on board a satellite, for example. And this has actually been demonstrated. What, once again, the public doesn't generally recognize it, but it's actually part of our everyday life. And what do I mean by that? The GPS system. Okay, we actually found that this effect occurs with that system. And the GPS system works because of the fact that you have this little unit in your car. Okay, and they're right now above us, 24,000 miles above us. Okay, there are satellites that are orbiting. Okay,
and they've got to be in that geosynchronous orbit, right?
That's right. About 12,000 miles above us, there are actually 24 satellites that are orbiting. And these satellites are sending a signal at a certain time that reaches your unit at a certain time. Okay? And because we know the speed of the signal that's being sent from the satellite to the Earth, it's actually a signal that's traveling at the speed of light, that we can actually calculate using the fact of the time that the satellite sent the signal, the time that your unit and your car gets it, and we can actually calculate the distance anywhere here on the surface of the Earth. But here's what the problem was happening. When the engineers were setting the system up, it was not working right. That is to say, it was having errors. It was actually giving the wrong locations. What they had initially forgotten about when they consulted with the physicists was they found out that they had forgotten about Einstein's theory of gravity. That is to say that the clock in your unit, in your car, because it's close to the surface of the Earth, that clock is actually running slower than the clocks on board the GPS satellites. So that meant that they were actually out of sync. So they had to use computers to calibrate for that correction. And when they did that and took that into account, then the system worked perfectly so that this actually shows that time is affected by gravity. And I like to think of the fact that without Einstein, we'd really be lost.
And how can you differentiate, Ron, the amount of time?
You can actually calculate how time will actually change depending on how far you are from the way from the surface of the Earth. That is to say, there's a precise formula that shows that the farther you are from a gravitating source, the faster time will go. In other words, the closer you get to a gravity,
the slower it is.
The slower time gets. So, and that is extremely important for my work. Incidentally, that leads to the first notion of a natural time machine, because there is an object in the universe that has the strongest gravity of all. And I know that most of the audience has probably heard of it. It's called a black hole.
That's right.
And a black hole is just simply a star that has collapsed to a certain point that the gravity around the star is so great, when the star uses up its fuel, stars start to collapse.
Now, and when you say collapse, explain that for the moment we've got here, Ron.
Sure.
When it physically collapses, does it like implode within itself?
In fact, implode is exactly the correct image. That is to say that normally all normal stars, and our sun is a typical example, work because there's an internal thermonuclear furnace that's essentially burning hydrogen to form helium. Okay, that's a basic mechanism. It's a little bit more subtle, but that's basically it, is that hydrogen combines to form helium, and the energy that's given off, that's called thermonuclear fusion, okay, where you bring atoms together.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy difference between the original hydrogen and the resultant helium, that little bit of energy via Einstein's equation equals mc squared, gives us our energy and our light and life, what we get from the sun. Now, what happens is that our sun is in a delicate balancing act. That is to say that the internal furnace that's in there is pushing the gas outward, but the gravitational forces of the gas are pulling inward. Okay. Eventually, what will happen in our star, sun, it's about 5 billion years, but if we look at other stars that are, let's say, larger than the sun, eventually, when their internal furnace burns out, then just like what will happen to our sun, the sun will start to collapse because there's no internal pressure anymore. So the star will actually start to collapse because gravity is now pulling inward. And so the star is actually contracting. As you said, it's imploding. It's actually contracting. The star is actually contracting. And as the star contracts, the gravity around that star starts escalating. It becomes greater and greater and greater as the star starts to collapse, okay, as it's, pulling inward. And what will happen eventually is that the gravitational field around the star will become so great that the light, the very light that tries to escape from the star, we don't think of light as having a weight, but as the light tries to get away from the star, the light will actually be pulled back. It's just like when you toss a ball up, the ball comes back down. The light that tries to leave from the star will actually get pulled back to the star. And, of course, if you're standing outside the star and all of the light that's trying to get away gets pulled back, then you see nothing.
Let's talk more about this with Professor Ron Mallett, author of The Time Traveler. We'll also get into what kind of a device he thinks he needs to go back into time.